Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Kevin, let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today, we have Dr. Thomas Reed, colorectal surgeon and professor of surgery at the Leahy Clinic and co-editor of the prestigious journal Diseases of the Colon and Rectum. Today, in the dissection of the day, he'll discuss with us the complexities of managing patients with rectal cancer. In our opening shot, we'll do a primer of rectal cancer surgery and how it has evolved. For our random fact of the day, we're going to hear about the hemorrhoidal saint. And for tips and tricks, Dr. Reed is going to walk us through tips on how to avoid the ureters. And now to our opening shot.
Okay, so we are lucky enough to later on talk to Dr. Tom Reed, who is a professor of surgery, and he is a colorectal surgeon at the Leahy Clinic in Boston. So we're going to talk more about the surgical aspects later on in the podcast. So I thought we'd focus on this opening shot about the multimodality treatment of rectal cancer. So, Kevin, tell us a little bit about the previous dogma associated with rectal cancer.
Well, traditionally, it was that the APR is the procedure of choice. And then slowly that kind of evolved into that the LAR is the procedure of choice. And now it seems that people are preferring local excision as a procedure of choice.
And absolutely. And I guess you can extend that further beyond to say that those patients that respond and have chemoradiation therapy, that no surgery is the potential treatment of choice. And so, Jay, we know that techniques in rectal cancer, it is a technically driven operation, that the techniques are and technical aspects are very important when it comes to outcomes. So what has been some of the evolution of how the actual surgery is performed?
Well, you know, initially these surgeries were done, you know, kind of in the dark, bluntly, and you had to do a blunt pelvic dissection. Later, we discovered that the benefits of doing a sharp total mesorectal excision. And now, you know, we're kind of leaning towards a subtotal mesorectal excision.
Yeah, and it depends, obviously, for the last one in terms of the tumor height. You know, sure. Do we have to take the entire mesorectum for those upper rectal cancers, or can we just go down a little bit more? So we've also seen a similar type one in terms of the adjuvant therapy, that radiation therapy was ineffective, and then postoperative chemoradiation was mandatory for stages 2 and 3, and then the thought process was that, you know, maybe chemoradiation is toxic and unnecessary after adequate surgery. And this whole realm of ideas of postoperative versus preoperative conventional and preoperative short course. But really what we're trying to focus on is in terms of there's a fine balance, Kevin, when we talk about rectal cancer therapy specifically. And there's kind of a teeter-totter, if you will. On one side, you have one thing and you're trying to balance that with the other. What is that all about?
Right. So on one side of the balance, you have to take into account the patient, what morbidity are they going to undergo from this surgery, and the mortality rate if this surgery is performed, and then the function, what functional outcomes will they have. And on the other side, you're balancing this with, you want to get a cure. That's the main goal of this.
Yeah, so if you're trying to basically think about this, you're trying to say that, you know, we can cut it all out and we can hook you back up together, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the patient's going to have adequate function. And also, we can do less is more and do a local excision, but is that going to be, you know, definitely that's going to be associated with morbidity rates that are lower, but are we going to get the optimal cure that's in things? So when you look at rectal cancer papers, essentially what we're trying to look at is analyzing results in terms of survival. What's the cure rates? What's the local recurrence rates? And then other things specific to this operation. Stoma, what's the morbidity? How's their urinary function, the sexual function afterwards? And then what's the function of the GI system? Are they continent after this goes on? So taking a little bit back look in terms of a total mesorectal excision, it's important to kind of understand. We throw that term around all the time. Jay, what is a total mesorectal excision?
Yeah, with total mesorectal excision, the rectum and its mesentery are a single fascia enveloped unit. It's anatomically separate from the surrounding pelvic structures.
And why is it so important?
Well, a surgical violation of this anatomic package leads to a positive circumferential margin, and this is a known predictor of local recurrence.
Yeah, again, so posterior to that rectum, where the lymph nodes are located and where you can have local disease or recurrence, you know, from that, we don't want to violate this plane. We want to stay in that sharp avascular plane as we work our way down past the tumor. And classically, you would, you like you said earlier, you'd stick your hand down there, you do that Blunk dissection, you kind of hear that thwop. And then all of a sudden, you would pull it up and pull it out. No longer is that the case. You know, Bill Heald in 1982 in his famous study, British Journal of Surgery, talked about a total mesorectal excision where, although this had been done previously, kind of popularized it and definitely throughout the world has gone around giving TME workshops, but taking a sharp dissection on along that presacral, just in front of that presacral fascia in the avascular plane, going below the tumor, getting it all the way down the envelope, and then working your way back up. And so we know a couple of things about this. Jason mentioned one of them. Kevin, in terms of both the outcomes associated with patients who have a circumferential margin that's positive versus negative, how does that impact both local recurrence and survival?
Right. So if you have a circumferential margin that is positive, you have almost a 75% chance of a recurrence. And then the same goes if your circumferential margin is negative, you have a much elevated survival over like 60%.
Yeah. So again, that data that you quote is from the paper that's almost 20 years old right now, but it does show the point that if you have a positive circumferential margin, you are, you know, exponentially increasing your local recurrence, and you're also affecting survival as well. We do know that local recurrence is surgeon dependent. Those surgeons, it's not too surprising if you have pancreatic cancer or liver cancer or anything else, rectal cancer similar, and that if you do more of these in general, that you have a lower rate of local recurrence. And Torborg Holm in 1997 showed this from there. But the question comes all the time is that, do we always need to do a TME? Because Jason, there are some disadvantages potentially, and we're going to ignore cure right now, but there are some potential disadvantages to a TME. What is that?
Well, in order to perform a TME, you're operating very low. And so that means you're going to have a low anastomosis. And These have been associated with a higher leak rate, sometimes an inferior functional result, and a greater need for proximal diversion.
So the question comes, do you always have to have a total mesorectal excision for those upper rectal cancers? Can you do just get 5 centimeters past the tumor, making sure you're coming across at a right angle and doing a subtotal mesorectal excision? In general, what we're trying to say is we're trying to get anywhere. Tumor occasionally will go up anywhere from 3 to 5 centimeters past in the mesorectum itself, where you can find a lymph node disease in there. And this incidence is still pretty low, anywhere from 5 to 24% as we go along there. So again, the focusing on the aspects, there's been a couple of different studies out there that show the impact of performing a proper TME. And probably the majority of this was written by Anna Martling in Lancet in the year 2000, which they quoted the Stockholm TME project, where they went around, they did instructional workshops, they taught their pathologists how to basically do histopathology, and really showed, even if they weren't colorectal surgeons or specialists in rectal cancer, that you could make a difference by properly training people to be able to do it. And they had a couple of different ones, the Stockholm 1, the Stockholm 2, and the TME project. And Jason, in terms of APR rates, in terms of local recurrence rates, and in terms of cancer death rates, by simply teaching surgeons how to properly perform a TME, what impact did it have on those particular patients?
Well, the number of APRs went down. The percentage of APRs being performed went down. The percentage of local recurrence went down, and as did the number of cancer deaths significantly.
Yeah, so your sphincter sparing went up. You had morbidity and mortality that were improved with doing that, and your local recurrence rates almost dropped from 15% all the way down to 6% when you looked at the Stockholm 1 versus the TME project. And again, rectal cancer is a technically driven operation. When you consider the fact that adjuvant radiation therapy, we know a couple of things. We know that it improves local recurrence. There's a couple of small studies that will, you know, talk about survival, and we'll ignore that for right now. But we do know that it does potentially have a downside, and that downside is that it is associated with in the pre-op setting, it's going to be a harder operation because you've had that area that's been radiated before, and it potentially increases the chances of having you have higher morbidity rates. And so as we go along, we talk about the modality therapy. There's been a couple of big studies out there. And probably one of the ones that comes up in the beginning was the Swedish rectal cancer trial. This had 1,168 patients. And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1997. And what they looked at is they looked at surgery plus radiation therapy and then versus surgery alone.
Mm-hmm. Now and that's pre-op?
And they divided this out at different Duke stages and then overall looked at all the patients. In local recurrence in general, Kevin, what were the local recurrence rates if you had the addition of having radiation therapy? And this is in a post-op setting.
In the post-op setting, it was about 11% versus 27%.
Yeah, so by the mere addition of radiation therapy, again, performing a TME in these patients, what you had is you were able to drop your local recurrence from 27% having surgery alone down to 11% when you had the addition of radiation therapy. Now, this was one of the ones that showed that there was a difference in survival. Survival with the addition of radiation therapy was 58% versus surgery alone was 48%. And this was statistically significant. But again, this is probably one of the outliers when you think about it.
Well, that's at five-year survival. Right?
Yeah. So importantly, what we're trying to get to is the take-home messages for the Swedish rectal cancer trial was that radiation therapy was given pre-op. I'm sorry if I said post-op earlier. No chemotherapy was given. And that's something that was different between the other ones. And although TME was a component of it, it wasn't standardized like we know TME now. And remember, this is already coming up on quite a bit ago. And it's one of only three studies out there in the literature to show a significant survival advantage with this. And so this led to the trial by Capogen, and I'll probably pronounce that wrong, but in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Dutch TME trial. And this was published in 2001, and this showed a preoperative RT plus a TME versus TME only. And so what they typically did is they took 1,805 patients, and they randomized them to undergo a TME only versus preoperative radiation therapy, and then TME after this. And when we looked at these particular patients and followed them out, again, if we were to break them down by TME stage, Jason, what did you see?
We saw with the group that underwent surgery plus the radiation therapy, you saw a significant drop in the percentage of local recurrence at 2-year follow-up. And this went up as you kind of increased in stage.
Yeah.
To where, you know, TNM stage 4, you dropped from a 24% local recurrence rate all the way down to a 10% local recurrence rate.
Yeah, and in the ones where it probably matters a little bit more in stages 2 and stages 3, your local recurrence rate with surgery alone was 6% down to 1% with radiation therapy. And in stage 3, surgery was 15% down to 4% with the addition of radiation therapy. So the overall recurrence rate with the addition of radiation therapy, again, was 8.2% for the entire cohort with a follow-up at 2 years down to 2.4%, so roughly a fourfold decrease. So when we consider and we follow these patients out, the thing, unlike the Swedish trial, there was no difference in overall survival at 2 years mm-hmm. between those patients who had radiation or radiotherapy plus surgery versus surgery alone. So really, as we go forward, the next major one that we talk about is the preoperative versus post-op. Kevin, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages to having preoperative radiation therapy?
Right. So some of the advantages include you can shrink the tumor and allow it to be downstaged, which increases the resectability and increases your ability to perform sphincter-sparing procedures.
Yeah, and in addition, in the preoperative setting, you have that rectum in the way, so the small bowel can't sneak down in the pelvis where it's radiated as much, so you have a focal target and you have a decreased risk to small bowel. What are some of the potential disadvantages to preoperative radiation therapy?
Yeah, this can hinder your operative experience with all the scarring, and it can actually hurt healing in the postoperative phase.
Yeah, so essentially you have the potential that you're overtreating, that you're clinically staged them wrong, so you're giving radiation therapy to patients who don't need them. definitely, if you're operating in a radiated field versus not a radiated field, you're going to have some technical difficulties that may be slightly higher in the post-radiated field. And then you always worry about healing and anything like that. Jay, when we focus now upon post-operative radiation therapy, again, what are some of the potential advantages versus some of the disadvantages to the post-operative radiation therapy?
Yeah, it's kind of the inverse of the advantages and disadvantages for pre-op. You know, some of the advantages of you can accurately stage before you decide to treat with the radiation. You're not operating in a radiated field, so the operation itself might be technically easier, and you can allow the patient to heal without exposing it to radiation first. The disadvantages are that it may decrease resectability. You don't have that tumor downstaging that you would have if you treated preoperatively. You might have more sphincter sacrificing procedures, and you have that risk to small bowel because it sneaks down in the pelvis. The rectum's not there to take up that space anymore.
Yeah, so APR rates go up, and definitely when you're radiating your post-op anastomosis, definitely your function might also increase. So a couple of different trials have looked at this. Probably the most famous one was by Sauer in New England Journal of Medicine in 2004. This was the German rectal cancer study group. Preoperative versus postoperative chemoradiation therapy, 823 patients, and they randomized T3, T4, or node positive, so we're focusing on stage 2 and 3 patients. The preoperative group got a standard regimen of 50-40 centigrade and 5-FU at weeks 1 and 5. They got TME 6 weeks later, and they had 4 cycles of 5-FU 4 weeks postoperatively. The postoperative group got their TME. They had chemoradiation therapy 4 weeks postoperatively, and they got an additional 540 centigrade boost to the tumor bed. Now, when you look at local recurrence between the two cohorts, between those patients who had preoperative versus postoperative, Kevin, what were the ultimate results?
So the patients that had the preoperative chemoradiation had significantly decreased recurrence rate, 6% versus 13% in the post-op chemoradiation population.
And what about survival between these cohorts?
The survival was about the same for both the cohorts, out to 60 months.
Yeah, and so you had the overall survival was no difference between the preoperative or postoperative course, being 76% versus 74%. And even when they stratified it by disease-free survival, similar again at 68 versus 65%. But we mentioned, Jason, earlier that you had some patients that had it's not only just the local recurrence, but it's also the ability to have in continuity management. So what were the rates between an APR that was deemed necessary in the preoperative cohort and postoperative care cohort, and then ultimately the sphincter sparing surgery performed between those who had preoperative chemotherapy versus postoperative chemotherapy? So how often were they able to spare the sphincter?
So in the preoperative chemoradiotherapy, 39% of the time they were able to. In the postoperative chemoradiotherapy, 19% of the time.
Yeah, so that's a big deal. And when you talk about ahead of time when they said, hey, are we going to have to perform an abdominal perineal resection? In the preoperative group, they thought going into it that 28% of the time this was going to need to be the case versus only 20% of the time. And you can see that indeed. That we were able to have much higher rates when you gave it preoperative chemotherapy. So your take-home points, Kevin, for preoperative versus postoperative chemoradiation therapy?
So the pre-op chemoradiation therapy definitely decreases local recurrence. It increases sphincter preservation. There's no overall difference in complications, and there's no overall difference in survival.
Yeah, so again, we don't want to focus on a lot of this, but as we get more and more into kind of rectal cancer being the paradigm of breast cancer and, you know, having equivalent oncological results by incorporating this multimodality therapy, local excision, and something we're not going to touch as much time on today in terms of watch and wait type strategy, but local excision also has some potential benefits for rectal cancer. Low morbidity, mortality, you're avoiding that big operation, so you avoid the sexual urinary bowel dysfunction and avoid the colostomy, but the downside to it, it's not necessarily all good. So what are some potential downsides to a local excision?
Well, you can't assess the nodes, so you can't adequately completely stage the patient.
Mm-hmm.
The involved nodes are not excised, And it has a questionable oncologic result when compared to radical excision.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different papers out there that some say it's great, and others say that you know, that probably if you have a patient that is risk profile will do it, that potentially if they're willing to go along with it, doing a standard radical excision. So, you know, staging becomes even more important. And I think that when you look at endorectal ultrasound and you look at lymph node staging and MRI for this, obviously we would want to make sure that we stage the patients and said we have an ideal patient to undergo a local excision. And that's really kind of the take-home point. Because if you're inaccurately saying that a patient doesn't have any nodes and you're potentially leaving positive lymph nodes behind, mm-hmm. that's a problem. And so endorectal ultrasound in general, accuracy rates show, you know, about 80 to 90%, sensitivity 70 to 80%, specificity 90 to 91%. When you look at end staging accuracy, the large study out of Minnesota demonstrated that, you know, about roughly two-thirds were correct in their nodal staging, and there was about 10% understaged and about 25% overstaged. And so when you went forward on these particular patients, what we're finding, you know, when I was training in residency, we used to say T2 all the time. But in general, T2 ones, your risk of local recurrence for a T2, and one of the largest series out there, the Minnesota series, demonstrated that your local excision was 47% for T2 lesions versus only 18% for N1 lesions. And, you know, again, there's lots of different ones out there, and that demonstrates the local recurrence anywhere from 17% and all the way up to 50% for T2 lesions. In general, T1 lesions aren't as much. So survival in general, local versus radical excision. For local excision, for T1s versus radical excision, lots of studies out there will show that that they're fairly equivalent, although there is one large study that demonstrates that there is a higher overall survival undergoing a radical surgery for T1 lesions, but definitely that overall survival drops out with T2 mm-hmm. lesions, and that probably local excision in an otherwise healthy patient that can do it. Kind of taken up, I think the take-home points as we wind up here, our opening shot on this multimodality therapy, is that it's important to understand that with local excision, at first, this is an excisional biopsy. You can't just skive off the top. You need to perform a full-thickness biopsy on these patients. And probably more importantly, what you don't want to have is you don't want to have a patient who undergoes a positive margin. Because if you have a positive margin, you're leaving tumor behind. So your local recurrence rate is definitely going to be much higher, even if you add chemotherapy and you compare those patients who have negative margins who have chemotherapy versus a positive margin with chemotherapy. Those patients who have a positive margin, even if you add chemotherapy, they're going to still roughly have about 3 times the local recurrence rate for those who don't. So compared to those patients who have negative margins, and you have no chemotherapy, you're going to have well less than having local recurrence, well less than 10%. So in general, your basic take-home points for this is to understand the fact that rectal cancer is the true multimodality therapy, and without focusing on even as we get down in the watchful wait type strategy, the optimal therapy of it is taking your patient in front of you, understanding what's their quality of life, what's their tumor, what's their tumor biology, how are they responding to them, getting accurate staging, and then matching that particular operation with what the tumor is in front of you. So that ends it for our opening shot, and we're looking forward to having a discussion with Dr. Tom Reed, who is a colorectal surgeon, professor of surgery from the Leahy Clinic in Boston.
Well, I know what that sound means. It's time for today's random fact of the day.
So we're going to talk today about St. Fiacre, who's the patron saint of gardeners. Now, he's been recognized as the patron saint of gardeners as well as cab drivers and florists, among other things, since medieval times. He was born in Ireland in the 7th century, and he was raised in a monastery. Now, during the Dark Ages, monasteries were repositories of learning, and it's here that Fiacre became a skillful user of the healing herbs. As he learned his fame and earned fame for knowledge of plants and healing abilities, disciples flocked to him. And so Fiacre sought more solitude and left Ireland for France, where he established an hermitage in a wooded area near the Marne River. And it was here that Fiacre built an oratory in honor of the Virgin Mary and a hospice where he received strangers. He himself lived retreated in a solitary cell, and he lived a life of prayer and manual love and labor of his garden. But Jay, that's not why we're talking about St. Fiacre.
No, that is not.
What else was he the patron saint of?
Well, he's actually my favorite patron saint because he's the patron saint for hemorrhoid sufferers.
Awesome.
So while he was working very hard in his garden, he developed hemorrhoids. And one day he sat down on a stone, which he claimed gave him a miraculous cure. The stone actually survives today, and many people take a pilgrimage to the stone in hopes for a similar cure. During this time, severe hemorrhoids were treated by medieval physicians using cautery irons to treat the problem, and others believed simply pulling on them with their fingernails was the solution.
Ouch.
This was the solution actually advocated by Hippocrates. It wasn't until the 12th century that a Jewish physician wrote a 7-chapter treatise on hemorrhoids and disagreed with the use of surgery, instead prescribing the most common treatment, the sitz bath.
And that has been your Random Fact of the Day. Welcome to Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Thomas E. Reed today, who is a senior staff surgeon in the Department of Colorectal Surgery at Lahey Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington, Massachusetts, and a professor of surgery at Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts. Tom, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, looking at all you've done, I guess, you know, the question that I want to start off with more than anything is, where do you find the time to serve on this national committee, that national committee, co-editor of a journal, doing manuscripts, teaching, and finding the time to be able to operate? Is this something that kind of evolved and you fit it in? I recognize we're all busy, but how do you go about your daily basis?
Well, I think it's difficult because there has always been a myth of protected time in academic medicine, but I've never seen any protected time. If anyone has a job with protected time, please call me. And you basically have to do things, nights, weekends, fit it in here and there. But if you're passionate about something and you feel like you're contributing and you're getting something out of it, you find a way to do it. I think the tricky part is doing it while maintaining your good relationships with your family and friends. It doesn't leave a lot of personal time. I've never golfed in my life, for example. I basically work and hang out with my wife and son.
I've heard you have at least one hobby, which is scuba diving. I hear you're actually a pretty avid scuba diver. How do you find time for that, and where are your favorite places to go?
Well, I love being underwater. It's an incredible world under there that few people get to see, and I like to take pictures and videos, especially of fish and fish behavior. I like to travel. Unfortunately, my favorite places are halfway around the world, yeah. Literally in the Solomon Islands and Borneo and Indonesia. I've got a couple bucket list trips coming up this year, so I'm looking forward to those.
And you got to tell us where those are, and you also got to tell us what is the favorite thing that you've captured or moment that you captured underwater?
Well, there's something that everyone should do before humans ruin the planet, which is to go to Cancun in June and July and go snorkel with the whale sharks
yeah.
who congregate about 20 miles offshore in a plankton bloom that happens in the summer. Basically, the currents coalesce the plankton in one spot. And I've had the best 2 hours of my life swimming with about 50 or 60 whale sharks and manta rays. It was just unbelievable. And my wife and son were there with me. It's incredible. Anyone can do it. You don't even have to know how to swim that well. They just put a life preserver on you and you float around with these huge creatures. It's just absolutely spectacular. So everyone should do that.
So you currently work at Lahey Clinic with the fellowship, and you know, one of the things we wanted to touch base with you is about, you know, the state of residency training, residents coming out and making it into transition.
And sir, we have a bunch of residents listening that are going to be applying to fellowships and interviewing. What advice would you give to residents when they're deciding and choosing a fellowship?
I think you should try to pursue a field where you feel like you fit in and you enjoy being with the patients. For example, I had an interest early on in neurosurgery because I'd done some neuroanatomy research, but I really enjoy talking to my patients and telling jokes all the time, and I like constructive work, that is, rebuilding things. And I found neurosurgery, while it's a fantastic field, there wasn't a lot of construction of stuff. You were basically, in brain surgery at least, just removing tumors. And even if you did a spectacular tumor operation in the brain, you lost some normal function. And that sort of turned me away from neurosurgery. Colorectal is a fantastic field. I think we are in the golden age of colorectal surgery. And I have never regretted my decision to be a colorectal surgeon. It's a spectacular thing to do.
Tom, you've grew up in the Midwest, went out east, then went west, and we're in the Midwest back again for a short term, and now out east. Any thoughts about moving around to embark on new challenges with jobs and, you know, taking that next leap of faith that this is going to be able to do? And any helpful hints for people who are earlier in their careers, especially who maybe find themselves in a position in a job where maybe they don't want to be in and are looking for that next step?
I think any transition is scary, and you do lose a bit. And what you lose most is your reputation in the hospital and in the community. Because remember, it doesn't matter whether you've discovered the cure to cancer, you've published in the New England Journal. If you move to a new job, all politics are local. So you're just the new person. What you gain, though, is you gain a new understanding of how a system works. You go with a fresh start. You may want to take on new roles, new challenges. And so while it is tough initially until you build your reputation again among your referring docs and the nurses, et cetera, I think it can be a good thing to move, especially if there's an opportunity for you. So I wouldn't shy away from it.
Tom, you've also won 14 teaching awards by residents and medical students. What do you think makes a good teacher? And how do you teach? And how do you balance between what you do in the operating room and what the residents do?
I think it is probably most related to your passion to do it, because there are not a lot of rewards except for mental rewards. And I wish more institutions would put hard currency behind teaching. That is, either with salary support or promotions, the way they do for research endeavors or grant funding. Because if you think about it, teaching is the most important thing I do. Mm-hmm. If I operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I can affect the lives of maybe 1,000 people I operate on in a year. But if I teach 20 colorectal surgeons to go out and do a good job, they can affect tens of thousands of people. So it's incredibly important, and it's been really rewarding to me. The young people coming up always challenge me because they're always very smart, and it always keeps me on my toes. Mm-hmm. So I've really enjoyed it.
All right, sir, now we're going to get into our dissection of the day, the segment of the podcast where we dive in a little deeper about a particular surgical topic. Since we have you with us today, we thought we would discuss the surgical management of rectal cancer. First off, let's just start, you know, kind of at the beginning and how you initially approach patients. Maybe they're you know, referred to your clinic and, you know, they have a rectal mass with a diagnosis of adenocarcinoma. How do you go about, you know, really addressing things in that first visit? What imaging studies do you want? How do you want to go about staging that patient?
So I think I'd start off by saying that I believe that caring for rectal cancer patients is incredibly complex and should be filled with a lot of subtlety and a great understanding that there are gray areas everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult to convey to a large number of people involved in the care of these patients. So for most of the national organizations who put out recommendations on how to evaluate and treat a patient, it has been difficult to deal with the complexity of the issue. And so the default has been to tell people to do one or two tests and then make all the decisions about that patient based on the results of those radiographic imaging studies. And I don't think that's necessarily a very sophisticated approach. So I think instead you have to choose what you think is best for every individual patient, not only based on the way the tumor appears in the wall of the rectum, based on what you believe the nodal status to be, which is a difficult thing to do, but also the patient's functional status, their sphincter status, and their pelvic morphology. And this is a huge issue because if you think about treating an anterior rectal cancer in an obese man with a narrow pelvis sitting right next to his prostate, it really doesn't matter what your imaging studies show. In general, you're going to give them as much upfront therapy as possible to give you the best chance of having a tumor-free margin when you resect him, because it's going to be really, really hard to do. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, if you have a more elderly woman with a wide-open pelvis who's thin, the world is your oyster. And unless the tumor is obviously growing into other viscera or the pelvic floor, almost everything you do will allow her to have a good outcome. So to answer your question directly, I would say that in the beginning, I try to get a handle on the position of the tumor and its fixation. I think that's absolutely critical. So I rely on digital examination and an endoscopic look in the rectum. I'll either use rigid proctoscopy and flexible sigmoidoscopy in the office, and I often use both. And the reason I do both is that with a rigid proctoscope, you can really tell what the circumferential position of the tumor is and get a better assessment of the relationship of the tumor distance-wise to the anal verge or the top of the anorectal muscular ring, which I think is what we should be measuring from. Mm-hmm. But I think FlexSig is often tolerated better by the patient and can give you a slightly different view, so I'll often do both in the office. The next step is to locally image the tumor. When we started doing this back in the day, we used ultrasound, and I had an ultrasound machine in my office, and we used it as the extension of the physical exam. In some institutions, Leahy included, the radiologists still hold control over the ultrasound, and I don't think it is quite as effective used in that way because the operating surgeon isn't wielding the ultrasound machine. And ultrasound is better for very superficial lesions in trying to figure out the depth of penetration in the rectal wall, but it's not very good for locally advanced tumors because of deformation of the balloon and artifact. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done here is mostly gone to pelvic MR, done with a rectal cancer protocol. We worked with the radiologist a number of years ago. In the beginning, when we started doing MR, there was a rectal coil that was inserted into the patient. If you've ever had an MR, you know it cannot be the funnest thing to have. Mm-hmm. And imagine that with a thing in your bottom the whole time. It's not fun. And also that coil, the rectal coil, would deform the tumor. So instead, what we do is we increase the time in the magnet and have special processing to give us what are often beautiful images of the tumor as it relates to the other viscera. Then after that, you want to get some assessment of their total body tumor burden. PET would be best, or CT PET, but usually insurance companies won't pay, and so we will do a CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, because obviously if they have metastatic disease, your decision algorithm may be swayed one way or another. And that's usually the workup, and obviously they need a complete colonoscopy and a good history and assessment of their anal sphincter function and anatomy.
What do you think the role for PET scan is? You know, I see a lot, more and more people are just getting PET. In this particular one, outside of the subtleties of maybe seeing something small in the liver, see if it highlights, routine use of PET in rectal cancer, does it have a role?
I don't know where we will end up. I would guess in 10 years people will be doing CT PETs for staging of malignancy if it's going to change your algorithm. And I say that to mean that if you have a small thing in the liver and a huge rectal cancer growing into something, it's probably not going to change your algorithm because you're going to deal with the elephant in the room first, give them chemotherapy, and then see what happens to the liver. Mm-hmm. So it may be, if we're talking about resource allocation, it may make more sense to use PET selectively rather than routinely.
Great, sir. To dive more into the complexity of rectal cancer, we're going to discuss a little bit about neoadjuvant therapy. So how do you use this, and if there's a complete response, do you still resect?
Well, how do you know you have it? Is this Kevin or Jason?
This is Kevin, sir.
Kevin, what year are you, Kevin?
I'm a three.
A three. So how do you know if you have a complete response?
I mean, on radiographic imaging.
So the X-rays.
And the rigid procto.
So you put the proctoscope in and it sort of looks good. Maybe there's a little ulcer there, but you don't see any huge tumor. And you do an MRI and there's a little fuzziness in the wall, but the radiologist says, well, that could just be scar. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm not torturing you just to torture you, but I'm trying to bring out the point that it is almost impossible to tell whether someone has viable tumor remaining in their rectal wall or their mesorectum based on clinical and radiographic examination. And it would make sense in how, if you understand how tumor cells get killed by radiotherapy. They don't get killed in a wavefront. It's like Swiss cheese, and so you can have viable cells in what otherwise looks like a normal piece of tissue. We have tried over the years our darndest to figure out which patients will indeed have a complete histologic response to neoadjuvant therapy who could then avoid proctectomy, because that would be the goal. We've done it for anal cancer, and some people are exploring that option with rectal cancer, and I've done it for a few of select patients. But it's a dangerous game because we have essentially failed to be able to predict with 100% accuracy using PET scan, using MR, using ultrasound, using clinical exam, or any of our other non-invasive modalities. It turns out that the best way to predict what's happening in the mesorectal nodes is actually to do a local excision of the original tumor site. And if you look at the histology of what's happening in the wall, it is then very predictive of what's happening in the nodes. Mm-hmm. The downside of that strategy is if you cut out a hunk of the rectal wall after radiotherapy, it often doesn't heal and can lead to significant morbidity for the patient. So at present, we don't have a great treatment algorithm that will ensure 100% success. And remember, if you elect not to operate on the patient, salvage may be difficult to achieve once the tumor grows later.
What about radiation for those higher rectal tumors?
So I think there's a gradation of response as you go more proximally in the rectum. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the more distal a rectal cancer is, probably the more it will benefit from neoadjuvant radiotherapy. We've seen from data mostly from Europe and Northern Europe that there appears to be a graded response starting in the distal rectum, getting the greatest response, then mid-rectum, then proximal rectum, rectosigmoid, etc. And I think it's not really about distance to the anal verge or, exact anatomy. What you're trying to do is radiate things that are hard to remove. So, and by that I mean things in the deep pelvis. And it all depends on pelvic morphology. So, for an example, if you have a sigmoid cancer flopped over and growing into the bladder near the trigone, we would radiate that patient. We would give them neoadjuvant chemoradiotherapy and maybe some more neoadjuvant chemotherapy before we operate on them because it's in the deep pelvis and the small bowel's out of the radiotherapy field. So the risk of toxicity is low and the benefit can be huge, even though that's a colon cancer and traditionally has not been thought to be amenable to radiotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about more of the subtle situations, you mentioned before about the problems associated with the fact that they don't all melt away in a uniform fashion. So how do you balance that out with the data that talks about sphincter-sparing surgery with neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy and the fact that you might, I guess the question goes to, you got a patient, they got a low tumor, your preoperative staging suggests that it invades the puborectalis. Now you go ahead and you get your neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy. You take that patient back, and it looks like it's kind of shrunk away. Do you still do an APR, or are you going to go ahead and hook that patient up below?
In general, I would still do the abdominal perineal resection. I don't really believe the data that says that the surgeon changes what they would have done.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about how those studies would be done. So someone, you'd see the patient in the office and they'd say, Dr. Steele, put your finger in, what operation would you need to do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can say anything off the top of your head, and you can bias your statement so that it looks like radiotherapy leads to a lot of sphincter salvage. Mm-hmm. So you could have a tumor in the proximal rectum, you put your finger in and you tell the research nurse, oh, this patient needs an APR, and then lo and behold, on the day of surgery, you do a restorative proctectomy.
Mm-hmm.
So those data are not really believable. Second, because radiotherapy does not kill in a wavefront, as we talked about, I think you need to do your operation based on what the tumor looked like before any treatment, and take out all the tissue that you believed was at risk when you met the patient.
Would this involve somebody, let's say, that was invading the bladder, then it melts away from the bladder, and all of a sudden now you're left with, you know, the possibility of doing an anterior exoneration versus being able to avoid that and just do a standard LAR?
You know, so these are excellent questions, and this is the subtlety to it all. So the difference between abdominal perineal resection and hand-sewn coloanal is that of some potential functional benefit, but some people would argue that functional results after coloanal aren't great, and you should just do the permanent colostomy and remove the pelvic floor because you could cure them of their cancer more efficiently or more reliably, and the functional differences aren't huge.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about a proctectomy only versus an exoneration with cystoprostatectomy and permanent urostomy, that's a big deal.
Right.
And so then you get into another gray area.
Right.
And I don't know the right answer. I've certainly made decisions like that in the operating room based on what I thought was best for the patient and been somewhat uncertain about it. I think you have to take those cases individually.
So let's go more into the technical side of the operation itself. And one of the things that always come up is that how do we get a good anastomosis? You talked a little bit before about, you know, a hand-sewn coloanal anastomosis. Walk me through how do you do exposure to do a nice hand-sewn coloanal anastomosis? And even before you get there, can you just take a step back and tell me, what are some of your tips and tricks to make sure that we get a negative circumferential margin, make sure we get the adequate lymph node harvest, and how do you do a good TME?
So obviously, that question could be answered with a three-day discussion or conference, but just mm-hmm. briefly, I think you need to plan your approach to ensure that you get all the tumor out and all the nodal tissue that's at risk. Remember historically that Cuthbert Esquire Dukes in the 1940s mm-hmm. described measuring circumferential margins, and then there was a collective forgetfulness until some surgeons in the 80s reminded us that it's important to get the whole tumor out of the pelvis. So we should never forget that and not focus so much on the distal margin, but getting all the tumor out. And you also need to remove the mesorectal package, which has the nodal tissue at risk. So when I plan an operation, depending on the level of the tumor, I may end up with different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when I start transabdominally. There are times when I may start transanally in lithotomy. There are times when I start transanally prone. There are times when I flip the patient from abdominal to prone. So I use all these different methods. For a very low tumor where you are uncertain as to whether you can transect the distal rectum just above the anal canal from a transabdominal approach, I think it's safer to disconnect the rectum working transanally where you can look at things directly.
Mm-hmm.
This can either be done before you do the transabdominal mobilization, and many times you can start your dissection in the plane around the mesorectum, and you'd be surprised how far you can go, and you don't even need any fancy instruments. You just use malleables and some retractors, and you can come halfway up the sacrum in a woman, especially. The tricky part about that dissection I find is in a man finding that plane as you come around laterally between the rectum and the prostate,
mm-hmm.
because you can follow the endopelvic fascia too anteriorly. So that's an area where I'm always cautious
mm-hmm.
with. Some people put a sills or a single incision laparoscopic port into the pelvis through the open anus and establish pneumoperitoneum, which can assist the dissection. And people have described good luck with that. And then from the abdominal portion, I think it's important to have your setup good up above. You need to have adequate exposure, whether it's open or laparoscopic or robotic. You need to have good help, good light. And my preference is to start proximally in the colon and then open the avascular plane under the mesosigmoid, find the hypogastric nerve trunks and sweep them posteriorly. And this will take me over the sacral promontory, and I follow this plane down posterolaterally until I get to the lateral stalks. Anteriorly in a woman, if you tack up the uterus or retract it up, if it's in, then that will help you find the plane between the rectum and the vagina. And then usually I do the lateral stalks last. In the old days, I used to bovie these at the pelvic sidewall and deal with the middle rectals with cautery and pickups, etc. I think putting big clamps on them should probably be avoided because you leave a big chunk of mesorectum behind. I know surgeons have done that in the past. And now we have bipolar vessel energy sealers, which are great, especially in the redo pelvises for taking things right at the pelvic sidewall. Mm-hmm. And then if you started from below, you can often connect your planes of dissection, which is very nice and reduces a lot of stress. If you're just mobilizing posterolaterally and then you cut down and you see your laparotomy pad, and then there are no worries. For the very complex tumors which are invading the pelvic sidewall, I like to do the approach of the GYN oncologists or the urologists and come out laterally over the iliacs and dive down. I sweep the ureters medially initially. You have to watch out for the superior vesical artery and come down along the pelvic sidewall in a plane traditionally wider than what's used by most colorectal surgeons. Mm-hmm. And then I will deal with the ureter after I've dissected in this area and figured out where the tumor was.
Sir, can you talk to us a little bit about how you decide when to divert?
Sure. I think, you know, fecal diversion can be a great thing as it can mitigate the consequences of anastomotic leak, but it does have its own set of morbidities. In our practice, where we follow every patient prospectively, dehydration in patients with new ileostomies is the number one cause of readmission across the board. So it's not a risk-free endeavor. However, I think for most patients with low rectal cancer who have low anastomoses, and by that I mean distal to the first rectal valve of Houston, I think strong consideration should be made for routine fecal diversion, especially if they've had neoadjuvant radiotherapy. I don't divert anyone, although I will say as I've gotten older, I probably divert more people. I think you can divert with a loop ileostomy or a loop colostomy. The data are not crystal clear as to which is better, but if you've done a low anterior and taken your splenic flexure down, taking your inferior mesenteric artery at the aorta, you don't have a lot of colon to bring up to make a nice colostomy unless you go back proximally on the transverse colon. And we tend to use loop ileostomies for that reason and for their ease of closure. But we are constantly rethinking that because of the dehydration issue.
Taking a step back and talking about something, in our opening shot today, we talked a little bit about total mesorectal excision versus subtotal mesorectal excision for those upper tumors. And the advantages and disadvantages, does a TME always need to be a T? Does it always need to be total? What are your thoughts on a subtotal mesorectal excision for those upper tumors and any technical points on that if you do it?
So I think TME has been one of the most misused monikers of all time, maybe even more than classic Coke. TME was really described as a surgical technique to mobilize the mesorectum. This wasn't new. Experienced rectal cancer surgeons had been doing this technique for years. But the emphasis on re-emphasis on surgical technique has served patients well. And the total part of it, although advocated by Heald and others, had some appeal because all the nodes in the mesorectum would be removed. it mandated that every patient would have either an anastomosis at the pelvic floor or risk having an ischemic distal rectal stump. Mm-hmm. And so the group from Mayo and the group from WashU have shown fairly clearly that there is not a great need to remove distal mesorectum that is more than 5 centimeters distal to the distal margin of the tumor. Because when you look at histologic studies of what's happening in the mesorectum, it's really rare for cancer to involve lymph nodes in the mesorectum more than a few centimeters distal to the distal margin of the tumor. So what's really important is that you mobilize the mesorectum in its avascular plane, and then about 5 centimeters distal to the tumor, take a right turn and transect the mesorectum and rectum at the same level. You want to avoid coning in on the primary tumor, and you want to avoid leaving mesorectum in the pelvis. Having said that, what that means is for most mid-rectal cancers and all distal rectal cancers, you will be doing a total mesorectal excision. But for the proximal rectal cancer, there's no physiologic reason to remove that distal mesorectum or rectum. And in fact, the patients will have better functional results if you don't.
How do you decide, or what factors play into your decision of how to approach the patient versus an open versus laparoscopic approach? And what's the role for robotics, and where do you see that going?
So I think it's important for every surgeon to realize that the patient with rectal cancer gets one chance for cure, and that's the first time. The surgeon needs to be thoughtful about designing their entire treatment algorithm from soup to nuts. The surgeon cannot just be a technician. They need to work with their medical and radiation oncologists and figure out a treatment plan for the patient the moment they meet them. And that treatment plan for chemoradiotherapy, surgery, chemo, and loop ileostomy closure takes a year. So there's a lot of planning that has to take place. Mm-hmm. The second thing that has to happen is the surgeon has to look into their soul and ask themselves, is the patient getting the best cancer operation with my approach? And I think we are still uncertain as to whether, even in experienced hands, a minimally invasive approach to rectal cancer is warranted, given some of the data we have to date. And there are more data going to be published. Clearly, in the ideal patient, the 80-year-old woman who's had many children, is thin, she has a proximal rectal tumor, you can choose any approach you want, and hopefully you'll get a good operation. But in the heavy man with the narrow pelvis and a distal cancer anteriorly based, I don't care how you do it, it's going to be really hard. So you want to make sure that you're not cutting any corners. I do all these things, laparoscopy. I tried robotics for a while. I did not see a huge advantage, so personally I stopped using robotics. I think they really, in my practice, robotics was potentially advantageous for a very small number of patients, essentially people getting a rectopexy alone for prolapse, maybe, or the laparoscopic abdominal perineal resection. And I tend to default to an open operation if there's any question. It's not that I don't do laparoscopic proctectomy, but I just am very cautious. And if I think there's even a 1% better chance of a good operation with an open operation, that's what I'll do.
Great, sir. And which of your patients do you offer a local excision?
So this is another difficult question. The data are crystal clear that the oncologic outcomes following local excision are inferior to those following proctectomy. However, it is somewhat unclear whether the overall survival is radically different. That is, the morbidity of proctectomy may be substantial and there may be some mortality associated with it. And local excision is obviously a much less morbid operation. So there are some data to suggest that the overall survival is the same, even though tumor-related deaths or disease-free survival is worse with local excision. So I will offer local excision to select patients who appear to have very early stage distal tumors, who completely understand that there may be some additional risk. My default is to offer postoperative adjuvant chemoradiotherapy to some of these patients if they have any suggestion that it might be beneficial. And we really don't know what the best way is to deal with these folks. It would be great if we could give them all neoadjuvant chemoradiotherapy and then do a local excision, and we'd have a much better idea of what's happening in their mesorectal nodes. But that treatment algorithm hasn't caught on because of the morbidity issues, as I've stated.
So who do you choose to give a chemo XRT to with the, if in the patient's getting a local excision?
So let's say you have a high-risk patient who has a T2 tumor on local excision, mm-hmm. who just is too sick to undergo proctectomy, but may tolerate radiotherapy with a little Xeloda, they would get chemoradiotherapy.
Gotcha.
A young, healthy patient who absolutely doesn't want a proctectomy, if they have a T1 tumor, but it's a T1 tumor that I can see and feel, mm-hmm. it's not the cancer in a polyp with unclear margins where you go back and resect and there's one cancer cell remaining in the rectal wall, but a real tumor that you can sink your teeth into, I would discuss chemoradiotherapy for that patient. I don't think our data are mature in this issue, and hopefully future studies will define the role of adjuvant therapy better.
Stepping away from the OR right now and taking you back to that initial introduction with the patient and kind of going through all these different subtleties, Tom, what do you say to the patient that says, you know, no matter what you tell them, you got them through, what do you say to them when the only thing rolling through their mind is, am I going to have to wear a bag? And that they just, you know, am I going to die? Am I going to have to wear a bag? It seems like that's a all too common condition that they come back to you and they don't remember much of anything else. Do you have any helpful hints for especially those in their early career that, you know, trying to have that patient encounter?
I think this is always a difficult thing. I mean, no patient wants to live with a stoma. No one does. I've never met anyone come in for an elective stoma for no reason. And this problem has been known for a long time. And there were surgeons in 1848 who told their patients it's better to part with one of the conveniences of life than life itself. I think that was Lorenz Heister in 1848. So people have been having these discussions for 150 years or so. I think that it's hard for patients to understand what a poorly functioning coloanal anastomosis would be. And this problem comes up a lot with elderly women who've had some degree of sphincter trauma during childbirth or pregnancy and may have some pudendal neuropathy. And they can control their stool and flatus in their normal routine. But if we take out the rectum, the compliant organ, and substitute a colon as neorectum, pouch, coloplasty, what have you, it will never function as well. And that may be enough to tip them into fluid incontinence. It's hard for them to grasp that. They don't understand it. Some do, and just like the ulcerative colitis patients who elect to have a non-restorative proctocolectomy, some of them are very happy. I think it's a difficult discussion. There are some decision analyses that have been developed. Robin Bushy in Canada has done some of this where patients are given visual aids to try to figure out what it means to make certain decisions about their care. Mm-hmm. So people are working on ways to assist patients with their understanding of the issues. But I will not make a coloanal anastomosis in someone I know who will be incontinent. I won't do it.
Great, sir. Now we're going to move to our tips and tricks section. This is where you give advice to help get us out of those sticky situations. The first situation we want to discuss is how do you identify the ureters and avoid damage to them?
So I think it's important to understand anatomic planes. There are a lot of ways to approach the ureter, and you should know all of them. I think it's very helpful for young surgeons, colorectal surgeons, and general surgeons to spend time in the operating room with GYN oncologists and urologists and see how they approach their pelvic dissections, because they will typically come at the pelvis from different angles, and it will teach you things that can get you out of trouble when the normal way you do it cannot be used. So I relish operating with skilled surgeons from other specialties, and it's almost I do that every week. As far as the ureters, I think on the left, what I would tend to do is to mobilize the colon, either going from medial to lateral or lateral to medial, to stay in that avascular plane and its plane recognition and not be seduced by going into the plane of the retroperitoneum. Because as soon as you cut through the retroperitoneum, there's an areolar tissue plane that looks great. But if you follow it, you will be in deep trouble because you roll the ureter and sometimes the gonadals medially and can transect them. And then once you hug the mesosigmoid and mesorectum, you should come right down on the hypogastric nerves, and your ureter should be just lateral to that. If you can't find them there, open up the retroperitoneum laterally and work medially until you find the ureter. And if you still can't find them, call a urologist, have them put a stent in, and know exactly where you are. On the right, I think it's similar. It's somewhat easier because your sigmoid is obviously usually not flopped over on the right and fused to the sidewall there, but the same principles apply.
Are there any situations where you would where you choose to preoperatively place stents?
Absolutely. I do a fair amount of reoperative pelvic surgery and complex tumor work, and if I think it's going to be a very difficult dissection, I will absolutely have the urologist place stents. And I know you guys are taught that based on uncontrolled retrospective studies that ureteral stents don't prevent injuries. They just help you recognize them. I think the people that write those articles haven't done enough complex reoperative pelvic surgery. I find stents in some situations invaluable. And if you think about, just like the radiotherapy question and sphincter preservation, how would you do the study to prove that a stent did or did not keep you out of trouble? Unless you randomize the patients, it's impossible to know. So absolutely use stents if you have questions about how the operation is going to go, or at least position the patient in a position favorable to your urologist. Always have access to the anus whenever you're in the pelvis or the left side of the colon, and think about how the urologist would need to put a stent in, whether you can put them supine split leg versus lithotomy.
Okay, so now we're going to go into our final five. The first question, what is the last song that you played on your iPod, and do you listen to music in the operating room?
I don't even know what an iPod is. I will tell you that my 15-year-old son signed me up for some music sharing program called Spotify, and I used it exactly zero times in the five-month trial period. Then I started paying for it, and he was in trouble and had to get it off my computer. No, I think in the operating room, it is important to have everyone in the right state of anxiety. And by that, I mean there has to be the appropriate focus without paralysis. If you have too much noise in the operating room, people are distracted. But yet there are some operating rooms where everyone is so intense that they can be paralyzed and it can work against you. So in my first job in practice, everyone was very intense, and I actually played 70s rock all the time and some late 60s. In my next job, people were less intense, and I had to turn off the music. And here at Leahy, I usually play sort of smooth jazz.
Backstreet Boys.
All right,
right, Backstreet Boys.
That's in Dr. Steele's OR, actually. Number two.
No, I know. He's got Lady Gaga and the Backstreet Boys going.
No question.
Number two, besides scuba diving, since we already talked about that, what has been your most memorable trip or vacation?
I love hanging out with my son and my wife, and we try to travel together and do things. And my most memorable trip, this is a tough one. I'd have to harken back to when I was a med student and worked as a travel agent to help put myself through med school. And I had my buddy in med school came from a family that emigrated from the Philippines. And so we decided to save up vacation and backpack around Southeast Asia. And we ended up in the Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand. We smuggled ourselves through Burma. And this was in 1985 when things were a little tense, I should say. And that was just a fantastic trip that opened my eyes to a whole another part of the world. That was probably my most memorable trip.
That sounds fantastic. Okay, to all our dedicated listeners, yes, Jason did misorder the questions. So we're going to go to the proper number two question. Tell us what hidden talent or special interest you have outside of the operating room.
Other than underwater photography?
Absolutely.
Well, I used to play music for a living, but wasn't good enough to make a living, so I ended up being a butt doctor instead.
Now, what music, just to clarify, besides the accordion?
Right. No, I used to play trumpet and a little drums, and you got to remember this was in the 70s and early 80s, so if you weren't Led Zeppelin and had all the teenagers spending millions of dollars on you, you played for people with money. Mm-hmm. So we played, and those people usually were older, so we played big band stuff from the 40s, played stuff from the 50s, 60s, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Chicago, things like that, Beatles. I played in two bands for money, and then I played drums in a rock band for fun.
Cool. Number four, what would you be doing right now, profession-wise, if you weren't a surgeon?
Underwater photographer.
Touche.
Snuck that in there in the final thought.
I knew it was coming.
Dude, I'm just as soon as the number gets high enough in the bank account, and my wife and son can live well no matter what happens to me,
Yeah. You'll
never see me again.
Brilliant. Number five, if you could go back to back in time and meet yourself on your first day of internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
I'm mentally censoring everything that's coming to my mind.
Go into underwater photography.
Right. Yeah, leave now. Don't anesthesia is what I did. I honestly, colorectal has been a fabulous field to go into. I've met incredible mentors. So I don't regret my decisions at all. I think I've learned so much from meeting people and learning things and hopefully helped a few people along the way. I don't know if I'd tell myself anything different. I'd have to just let myself experience it.
Fair enough.
Well, Dr. Reed, thanks so much for joining us on Behind the Knife. It's absolutely wonderful listening to your approach to rectal cancer and just going over and highlighting some of the subtleties that go. And so we look forward to having you back one day, and thank you again.
Thanks. Good luck, guys.
Yeah, I'll do.
All right, that's it for us today. Time for our closing count. Thank you for joining us at Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Reed for sharing with us his wisdom and experiences as it relates to rectal cancer. Join us next time as we go behind the knife with another in-depth discussion from a leader in surgery. Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.